All right, final session, last day. So good to see you here today. I have the great honor of introducing the next talk. Joel Duff from Akron University and Greg Davidson. What institution is he with? And I actually am very honored to be in this position to do this because Joel was one of the first scientist believers that I reached out to as a baby Christian because he was just up the road from me. I had purchased the book, Grand Canyon, A Monument to an Ancient Earth, and saw that Joel was a professor at Akron University. I reached out to him. He connected me with Ken Wolgemuth, who then connected me to ASA, and the rest is history, as they say. So I'm very pleased to introduce Joel Duff and Greg Davidson. And their talk today is Young Earth Evolutionists, Adaptation of Young Earth Creationist Models, and Implications for the Church. Welcome, Joel and Greg.
Start my clock here. Well, good morning. Greg and I are pleased to have that you've chosen to spend some time with us talking about this very important topic. Put in its broadest context, we might ask, what is the origin of the awe-inspiring biological diversity that we witness every day around us? The answer to this question has increasingly divided Christians. The typical lay Christian has been conditioned to think in bimodal terms on this topic, as if one side were upholding orthodox, conservative Christianity, and the other were just simply swayed by liberal tendencies. Our intention is not to provide a solution today, as if that were possible, but rather shed light on the inadequacy of this bimodal, simplistic viewpoint and promote tools and questions for further engaging and having productive dialogue. To do so, we're just taking off a small bite of this. We wish to bring to your attention the evolution of the young Earth model of origins that we believe has resulted in some substantial changes to orthodox traditions that young Earth creationists have typically sought to defend. In a sense, we're trying to update you on what is the modern, sort of the modern young Earth creationist model of origins. Aha. This presentation is broken down into four parts. First, we will describe the model being promoted by leading young Earth proponents today. This isn't necessarily the model that the average young Earth follower might fully recognize, but it is where the movement is currently headed. Secondly, we'll provide a very brief scientific assessment. And with that background on hand, we can explore the theological impacts of that model and the questions we think the church should be asking, how we can ask questions that are informed. So where do we begin? Well, the backdrop to the whole conversation begins in Genesis, right? Genesis 1 says, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seeds, and fruit trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed, each according to its kind." And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds." We'll focus on a single word here. That word I emphasize. That word is kind. It is a good entryway into having a conversation about origins and biological diversity, really with anyone of any persuasion. For most of church history, kind was understood to be akin to the animals that we're familiar with and produce other creatures of the same type. God has revealed to us that he's created everything and every creature. He further reveals to us that we can depend on these creatures, behaving according to his rules. So how does kind, this kind, figure into the new creationism that we're talking about here? The desire is to associate a kind with a discrete scientific taxonomic group. That desire only became acute for young Earth creationists with the realization that the world today contains a vast array of different types of organisms we call species. The 20th century young Earth community, intent on proving the scientific accuracy of the Genesis flood, came to the internal realization that all the Earth's existing and extinct species could not have fit on Noah's Ark. Then if that's the case, then the definition of a biblical kind must be broader than a species, maybe considerably broader. In 1996, John Woodmerap, published a seminal book attempting to explain how the ark could have fit all the animals. He estimated the ark only needed to accommodate 8,000 kinds. This was quite radical, even in 1996. Right? But today, displays on the Ark Encounter in Kentucky list 1,387 kinds that were on the ark, with a suggestion, if you read their literature a little deeper, that this might actually be an overestimate. Maybe many, many fewer were necessary to be there. So this leads me to think about the increasing inclusiveness of this term and how it's changed in its meaning over time. When one realizes that even extinct kinds were present on the ark, as we see here in this display at the Ark Encounter, the problem becomes rather daunting. Consider that conservatively, there have been at least 200,000 land-dwelling, air-breathing vertebrate species, things that would have needed to have been preserved on the ark. For Woodmerap, if God created 8,000 kinds, then each created kind would have had to have diverged into an average of 50 species since its creation. For Ken Ham, this problem is even greater. His conservative estimate of kinds requires that each kind would have produced 142 species on average. In the new creationism, there's a whole lot of speciation going on. Let me illustrate the overall model. If I were to describe, like, what's the general model that young earth creationists are now following. This figure provides an overview of the young earth model of what I would call evolution. Kinds are separate creations, that's a difference, made complete by the end of the sixth day of creation. But since that time, kinds have adapted, diversified, evolved, I guess pick your favorite term there, into the diverse species we see today. However, some animal kinds experience an extreme bottleneck down to two individuals followed by a re-expansion of diversity into all the species that we have today. AIG depicts some of these kinds and how they survived. Depicts some of the kinds as surviving the bottleneck, only to go extinct. And you see that on this figure, that some individuals made it through the flood, but then immediately went to extinct. So in summary, animal kinds, and presumably all other kinds, can trace their origins to common ancestors that gave rise then to the diversity that we actually witness today. Today, the typical Christian, I think, drawn to the young earth interpretation, and even progressive creationists as well, likely would feel that Adam encountered and named the animals that we are familiar with today, that we see around us, not some ancestral version that they wouldn't have recognized at all. However, the young earth community really has abandoned this view over the last 50 years, except for Homo sapiens. They have even moved beyond Woodmerap, who thought that a kind represented a taxonomic level of genus. Right? Now, a kind corresponds to an entire taxonomic family, and possibly even more, possibly an order. For example, the carnivora might include all meat-eating animals, from hyenas to harvest seals, none of which would have existed in that original creation or that Adam would have recognized. He would have only known a common ancestor of all those. So let me look at a brief example of this. Let's go back to these carnivores. This image is an example of the proposed creation and diversification model, starting with the ancestors of different carnivores at the family level. So we have an initial cat kind, we have a different dog kind, a bear kind, and so forth. Followed by then an adaption into the many species that we see today, including many extinct species. If we enlarge this figure, or we look a little bit closer, we'll find that ancestors in Genesis, if you go to the Ark Encounter, they actually have on display the original dog kind and the original cat kind, and they are pretty much what paleontologists think is the common ancestor to those particular families. And if I zoom this in a little bit, you'll see that this is what they may have looked like. Now, I don't know if you're, I think you're as an astute observer as I am, as a scientist. If you look at these images, you may be struck by the fact that all the common ancestors of these different families look very similar to one another. All right? So you might notice that the basal or ancestral kinds, the things that presumably are on the ark, actually look more similar to each other than the species for which were derived from them. Right? Who's to say that these then aren't really a single kind in themselves? Where's the dividing line? I was supposed to show that a little earlier. But lest you think that, oh, well, the variation within a kind is just, you know, some minor adaption and a few genetic changes, we would just note that if you looked at the variation between the extreme members of the feline kind, there's more genetic variation there, physiological variation, morphological variation maybe in some cases, than there is, we say, chimpanzees and humans. Just to draw out the apples to sort of apples comparison here. But let me let Answers in Genesis speak for themselves here. Answers in Genesis says this about carnivore origins. Here's a mitochondrial DNA phylogeny constructed by Answers in Genesis employee Nathaniel Jeanson. It genetically illustrates for us just what we see with our own eyes in the previous figure. The common ancestors for each carnivore kind are indicated by Jeanson as these circles. The circle represents where the common origin is. Right? Notice that each carnivore kind, common ancestor, is more similar to each other than they are to the descendants of those kinds of each other. We might ask, what would stop him from simply expanding his definition of a kind to include all carnivores? A carnivore, in this case, a carnivore kind, which would include cats and dogs. So the really important question, those are examples of sort of what the general message you might hear in today's modern, I'd say, neo-creationist view. But what's underlying is, like, what's the explanation for how this could happen? How did all these changes from two individuals to hundreds of species, how could that have happened? In order to accomplish these dramatic changes, young Earth models now acknowledge the validity of a number of mechanisms that they once mocked. Here I have listed some of those mechanisms of speciation. Beneficial mutations, not often in the literature, but it is there. Jumping genes, gene duplication, genetic drift, natural selection, vestigial organs occur within these kinds. Genetic imperfections, punctuated, there's a punctuated equilibrium model of creationist evolution, and even transition fossils. This is the language and the core of mechanisms that we think of as being evolution today. So all this means something that few in the church may have yet realized, and that is young Earth creationists are really young Earth evolutionists. They're accepting many of the concepts of evolution in most senses of the word. And yet they still declare that evolution is evil, which brings us to the obvious question. What are the differences? Right? There must be some differences, and I'm certainly not saying there aren't. All right, this isn't a big kumbaya moment where everyone's going to agree now. There are some significant differences, and we don't deny that those differences don't exist. I'm just going to briefly mention two of these. Evolution only occurs within kinds. I think that's fairly apparent. There isn't common ancestry between those, but again, we're having difficulty defining what a kind is. But also, there's front-loaded genetic diversity, or new genetic information can't occur in that model. It can only disappear. And so therefore, all the genetic information that was ever existed must have been front-loaded into the original kinds, the original perfect creation. And therefore, everything after that is sort of a spillover effect in which it's all just being separated out into the various little bits of variation that's left in this world. So we commonly see images like this of kind sort of degrading into lesser and lesser beings or ones that are mutated. So we have a number of scientific issues. Greg and I would take issue with a number of different aspects of this. I'll just highlight the first two. Genetic variation in their model should be running out over time. In other words, looking toward the future, it's a fairly grim future. There isn't any new genetic information. It can only be lost. And since species are going extinct and mutations are happening, eventually the future a few thousand years ago looks pretty grim in terms of genetic variation and diversity. Our world will be a less diverse place. But let me turn to really the more important topic, the theological impacts of this work. One of the key points of rhetoric for the young Earth creationists is that the creation model preserves biblical orthodoxy, right? That is the thing that the people hang their hat on. It's helping me preserve orthodoxy. But does it? Although we have serious issues with the science of young Earth creationism, our biggest issue is with the theological impacts of this burgeoning new form of young Earth evolutionism. We submit that some of the new views represent a steady migration away from biblical orthodoxy, even if they don't recognize that themselves. I'm going to try to provide six examples to support our concern. Right? Example one, concerning the biblical kind, since that's where I began. Consider the intention of Genesis 1. It is written in the midst of nations who believe that nature is chaotic, with natural processes serving at the whim of capricious and narcissistic gods. If it so amused the gods, a fish might become, may give birth to a whale or a sheep to a goat. Not so, says Genesis 1. Nature reflects its author. It is orderly and structured. But within the human, within human experience, we might add, within the human experience, and we might add within the scope of biblical chronology, cows only give birth to cows, giraffes to giraffes, and sheep to sheep. The young earth model overturns this assurance with suggestions that Adam and Noah didn't even know what a sheep or goat looked like. All there was an original bovid, or in some cases, maybe just an original ruminant, and giraffes didn't even exist in the garden or before the flood and have only recently been derived. A subpoint to this also is that biblical animals are familiar in the Bible and geographically consistent with our world. There's over 100 animals that we can find listed in the Bible. Some of these are have such details that we can identify what species they are. They're the same species that we know and understand today. How could such incredible changes be taking place within the scope of recorded human history, and there be no mention in Scripture of this vast, rapid speciation happening? What about, why not references to animals that we know that don't exist today or that live in other lands? Geographically, the Bible animals are the animals we understand to be in the locations that they are today. So within the scope of our understanding of history, within human history, they've remained similar. We also can see from contemporary art as well that images from early art show the same animals, even the same variety of animals that we understand today and know today. Example number two. Young Earth creationists, for young Earth evolutionists, a prohibition on increases in genetic information is imposed on Scripture, not drawn from it. The basic idea, young Earth idea, is that creation presented a perfect genetic code. Right? One that can't be improved upon. Therefore, any changes to the genetic code after sin must represent losses, not gains of information. But we might ask, where do we find such information in the Scripture? Where are we told that this is true? Consider examples from the Bible. Right? We know that some types of information have increased over time. Consider the knowledge gained by Adam and Eve upon eating the fruit. Well, we might not consider that the most positive example of increased information, yet it is a change. We also see God has given us his word, right, since the fall. That's an increase in information. How do we know that God has not allowed information in the sense of genetic information to increase over time? It appears that opposition to increases in genetic information is forced upon scriptures, not derived from it. Now, maybe it can't be gained, but we shouldn't exclude the possibility before ever looking for it. Example number three, the young earth view says that the initial created kinds were herbivores. Carnivory didn't enter the world until sin. So consider the creatures for a moment. Each of them is an exquisitely designed creature. We're in awe of these kind of organisms. The claws, talons, fangs, all these various things. Consider also wonderful characteristics that we often are amazed by as well. Here's a bird's nest down in the lower right-hand corner. It's adapted to blend into the ground surface for only one purpose, to hide from predation. So the logic here is God made herbivores during 6 days. Then he was done creating. Sin is responsible for carnivory and predation in a way. Therefore, sin is a creative force producing incredibly well-adapted and beautiful creatures. A creature on par, a creator really almost on par with God. That the things that we see and marvel at in creation are things that are results of sin. And what is the mechanism of that? Young Earth creationists only look to natural mechanisms to explain these things. God has turned into evil. This is maybe one of the more familiar examples. We look at verses like the heavens declaring the glory of God, as we just heard earlier today. Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are seen. Right? And the young lions roar for their prey. You open your hand. They're satisfied with good. But the young earth model says really the opposite. It says nature hasn't really declared the same message since creation. We have to divine our way to see the burning embers, I guess, of what's left of that good creation. Earth and cosmos declare the corruption of sin, and predation can't be good. But who are we to think that we can tell God what in nature is good and what isn't, especially when God has told us what is good? How can we go back against his word and use our words and our own idea of what perfection is above theirs? But I'd like to highlight, I'm running out of time, so I want to make sure I highlight this next one because I think it's a little less maybe well-known as an example of an issue here. And that is, this model is a God of limited power to preserve. Right? The biblical account of the flood tells us that God brought animals and birds of every kind to preserve life. But consider the young earth version now. Immediately or soon after the flood, more than half of all the kinds went extinct. According to the numbers posted at the Ark Encounter, Noah's rescue failed for 55% of all kinds. Entire kinds. That means families of organisms that are gone. Our world only has less than half of the diversity that God created initially in it. The world is running down in the young earth model. We started with tremendous diversity, and we're losing it all the time. And Noah's Ark did nothing, really, to help that. We simply lost half of it right after the flood. That's something that I think bears some thinking through, the importance of that. I'm just going to skip over the fine-tuning argument because that's another thing that is a philosophical argument that says that young earth creations are constantly bending the rules of nature, and therefore we're losing sort of a strong philosophical argument about the fine-tuning of nature, that God, the consistency of God is being lost through these new mechanisms that they're producing. But I want to move to questions for the church. Right? So these are things that I think are questions that emanate out of this information about what young earth evolutionists are now preaching and teaching. We should be asking ourselves, are we willing to abandon the traditional biblical understanding of kinds? Are we ready to say that Adam and Noah didn't know what a sheep or a goat or even a giraffe was? That this world that he knew and saw was a radically different version of the world that we see today? And we can't relate to it at all. Who created the exquisitely designed predators and adapted prey after day six? These are all questions we should be asking our young earth creationist friends, getting them to think about these topics and getting them to have a biblical understanding of these things. Where are increases in information after Edom disallowed? What does it say about God's power, the power of God, if more than half of his kinds didn't need to have really bothered getting on the ark because they were going to walk off the ark and immediately go extinct? What does it mean that if most of the mechanisms of speciation young earth creationists once mocked are now embraced in some form or fashion, and that they use really naturalistic mechanisms to try to explain all these things? So I want to say that most of these last items I've been mentioning are going to be further explored in Greg Davins's forthcoming book, Friend of Science, Friend of Faith. And I've also brought copies of my polar bear test, which also explores further some of these divisions between creationists. I haven't really talked about progressive creationists rather than done a comparison, but my taxonomy of different forms of views of origins is explained in that. I've got copies up front. With that, I'll take some questions. Oh, I better stand up.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. I'm reminded of Ron Umbers talking about Frank Lewis Marsh in the 30s. And he comes up with this concept, and this fellow creationist ostracizes being more evolutionists than the evolutionists.
Yeah.
So some big changes that have clearly occurred. I'm hoping you can help me understand, because I've really struggled to understand this in the literature. When we talk about a species, that maybe is arguably a natural object, maybe even at the genus level, but typically taxonomists say, well, family level is like a human construct and not an actual thing. And when I see the creationists describe a kind, and they say it's a family level thing, when Ken Ham talks about it, it seems what he really means is it's a species that's just a little more heterozygous than other things. But when the technical literature talks about it, they seem to think of it as something that's actually not a species at all. A kind is actually this other thing with this distinct genetic capacity that species don't have. Can you help me, I guess, understand what they mean when they say it's a family-level thing?
I can help you a little bit. I teach a class called Systematics. We spend 4 weeks talking about what a species is, just to figure out what a species is, in which we decide we don't really know at the end of that. But yes, artificial construct, and yet the need to have a kind be a real thing is necessitated by the fact that since the scripture talks about kinds being brought on the ark, therefore kind has to be a real thing. So I guess you could say, taking it back to scripture, they're finding their reason for looking at a kind as being a discrete thing that we must be able to identify, right? And have boundaries, and that we should be able to put some sort of markers around. That comes from that reading. So what are those boundaries? Some of those boundaries are being able to reproduce with one another. And, you know, we would talk about the same thing with species. You know, if a species is a bunch of individuals in a population are constantly reproducing with each other, we'd really call them the same species. You know, so is a kind just showing any semblance that in the past that they might have had an ancestor? And might have had an ancestor might mean that there's some sort of genetic, knowledge still left in them, that if you brought two disparate things, like a goat and a sheep together, they might be able to produce some semblance of an offspring. Not necessarily even the thing about the creationist literature, you don't have to produce a viable offspring to say that something's the same kind. All you have to do is have two cells come together, and maybe 4, 6, or 10 cells. That shows there's enough genetic continuity there that they understand each other, that they were once the same thing. So that becomes a very interesting definition for a kind there, and allows them to expand a kind greatly, because you can often find some really disparate species that can form at least that much of a link to each other. And there's another question, so I'm gonna stop there. Maybe I'll talk to you later, because there's a whole lot to that. But I don't want to cut everyone else off. I know I'm out of time.
Traditional argument against evolution was that, well, we're not seeing it today. You know, it's not happening now. It seems like they would want to be able to point to a lot of evolution going on now in this new model. Or is there a sense that they communicate that evolution is now slowed down since maybe this time of diversification?
Yeah, excellent question. Both are true. So I've seen both of those. There are different. I showed you one sort of summary statement of the creationist view of change, but there are so many individual models within that disagree with each other. So there is a punctuated equilibrium sort of model of immediate branching very, very quickly after the flood and forming hundreds of species. And then because the genetic variation has been sorted out, there's no more variation to sort out, so therefore speciation slows down. And so we wouldn't expect to see the same amount of speciation today as we did in the past. So the past was different than the present. But there are others like Nathaniel Jeanson. He thinks that speciation occurs at a constant rate. And he's constantly pointing to articles where cichlid fish or this example, or there's been articles just recently that have come out about a new bird species that evolved within the last 50 years, 50 generations. And so, see, look, it can happen really fast. And so using individual examples of some rare events to say, no, this is something that happens all the time. And he thinks that, that there's 4 subspecies of bovines in Africa. And within the next 50 years, we should expect that they're different species and that there'll be new species 100 years from now. So he's expecting constant and continuous speciation. Now, I would say that runs up against the fact that if you can't create new variation, where do you get the variation to create new species? You know, eventually it runs out and you end up with monocultures, essentially, of organisms. So there's some very interesting endpoints, and I think that's the kind of thing you need to know to have a conversation, is because here's what the outcomes are. You know, does this really make sense? Yeah?
One more question.
Okay, since there are different Young Earth Creation Organization, Institute for Creation Research Society, Answers in Genesis, and maybe more. Can you help us sort out, what you are referring to here as Young Earth Creation? Does that refer to any particular segment of this family, or is there a source we can go to sort this out?
Okay, so I think what I'm generalizing here would be the Answers in Genesis view, mostly because Ken Ham is the is the 10-ton gorilla in the room in terms of creationism. He's the one that sort of pushes the direction that they all go. But that doesn't mean that they're all the same. Institute for Creation Research has some folks that very much disagree with the model that Answers in Genesis has. They have a new creation museum opening. I'm really interested to see how they're going to present their form of evolution, because I know that they're pushing back against entire families or giraffes even having a common ancestor with a goat. That seems pretty extreme to them, as it does to me as well, at least within their timeline. So Answers in Genesis is the way to find out what most the average churchgoer that is hearing the creationist message, they're hearing the Answers in Genesis message. There are many other groups that are vying for different models, but it sort of percolates up, and Answers in Genesis sort of takes all that information, and then they're the one that is promoting it and pushing it forward. I better stop there.
Yeah.